Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of March. Should have a very interesting conversation ahead. Our guest is Professor Paul Carrington, a professor of law at Duke University, and he and 33 other prominent law professors and jurists have sent a letter to Vice President, the Attorney General, and the chair and ranking minority party members of the Congressional Judiciary Committee, calling for reforms of the Supreme Court. One of them, the Constitution, calls for a lifetime appointment. Maybe we should look at changing that. It's one element of American democracy that is not copied by other countries, perhaps because it is very undemocratic. The letter was sent on February 9 of 2009. There are four proposals of provisions, they say, suitable for inclusion in a Judiciary Act for 2009. The proponents don't agree on all of them, but they are unanimous that Congress should soon reconsider the law applicable to the Supreme Court of the United States, a subject it appears not to have seriously considered for at least 70 years. Our guest this hour teaches appeals, civil procedure, international civil litigation, and lawyers in American history, and is the author of several books, including Law and Class in America, Trends Since the End of the Cold War, Spreading America's Word, Stories of Its Lawyer Missionaries, Reforming the Court, Term Limits for Supreme Court Justices. And he has written extensively in other areas of the law. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Paul Carrington. And here's how you reach us. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Should you like to send an email, you can do that. And that's talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Professor Paul Carrington, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
My privilege.
Why is it that Congress has not looked at the Supreme Court and how to make it better in at least 70 years? That's a long time.
Well, it is. It's not an easy subject to broach politically. There's no political constituency out there for the structural issues. There are a lot of people who feel very strongly that the Supreme Court has done something wrong. And there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that it is a very virtuous institution that is the core of our national being. But there's nobody out there who really wants to think about the structural problems. I say nobody out there, I mean in the political universe.
Right.
You don't get a political constituency for it.
Mm-hmm.
The only guy in American history who ever really got busy on the subject of Supreme Court, of law governing the federal courts and the Supreme Court, was a guy named Evarts, who was basically responsible for the Judiciary Act of 1891, which was created the U.S. Courts of Appeals, and his mission in life was to end the kingly power of United States district judges. And God knows they were had kingly power, and of course, in some sense, they still do.
Mm-hmm.
Trial judges have a great deal of power over the people with whom they're dealing, and some of them do get pretty carried away with it, and for a long time, they were not adequately controlled and regulated, and they did a lot of pretty mean things. So Evarts got on that case and did it. Now, the other big law reformer of history is William Howard Taft.
Mm.
But his mission in life was to elevate the status of judges. He said while he was running for president that he just loved judges and that he thought judges were the kind of people he expected to meet in heaven. And he is the one who's primarily responsible for the law that initiated the practice of enabling the Supreme Court justices to pick their cases. They don't have to decide anything anymore. They just do what they want to do.
Right.
He also was responsible for building the palace in which the Supreme Court is situated. And he created the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is a very useful institution, but it makes the judicial branch self-governing, and it has done some good things over the years. But it further isolates the Congress from responsibility for major issues about the judiciary, and the Judicial Conference is helpless when they're thinking about the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do that. So There have been groups over the last 50 years who have tried to make recommendations about the structure of the federal courts, and but nothing ever happens. And a lot of the people who were signed on to that letter that we sent to Congress and to Vice President Biden and the Attorney General were people, were veterans of one or more of those episodes. I was involved in an American Bar Foundation project back in the 1960s, in which we recommended some changes that would and had some bearing on the Supreme Court. It was primarily addressed to the courts of appeals, but it was also trying to reformulate the responsibility of the Supreme Court for the courts of appeals, and just nothing happened because there was no we didn't have any political energy to apply to it. And then there was another group that was actually appointed by the Supreme Court to think about it, and they thought about it and came back with recommendations very similar to what the American Bar Foundation said, and they were told to go away by by Justice Brennan was offended by their suggestions.
Huh.
And then there was a third group. Senator Huruska from Nebraska got interested a little bit in it, and he said we ought to do something, and he appointed a committee, and they went and thought about it. Roger Crampton, who's one of the members of our group of 33, was very active in the Huruska study, and they came up with a report very similar to the one we had done before, and nothing happened. Senator Huruska didn't have the starch to get it on his get the Senate to face it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another group appointed by the Federal Judicial Center who came around, and then the last one was actually led by Byron White about a decade ago. And I think, interestingly, I think there's nothing in our comments or report that Byron White wouldn't have agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
But he you know, he'd tell you, yeah, it's all right, but he didn't know how to cause anybody to actually do anything. There right. wasn't there wasn't a lot of political energy behind it.
Right.
So that's the state of the world.
That's all right.
Anyway, this time we thought, what the heck? We'll put our ideas into the form of a statutory draft to see if that doesn't focus their attention, rather than just writing it as academic essays.
Mm-hmm.
We try rattling the cage of Congress.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's what we were trying to do, and we're still sort of at it. And
right.
Maybe, who knows, maybe something will happen.
Maybe. But, you want to get to some change before you go to heaven, right?
Yeah. Well, there were four schemes that we advanced, and they weren't all in these earlier reports, but some of them seemed to me almost irresistible.
Right.
One of them is that there ought to be somebody who would tell us, has the responsibility for telling a Supreme Court justice, sir, ma'am, your time's up. You're no longer doing the job. You're not qualified to continue in this office.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had numerous justices who just cling to their job and refuse to give it up because it's too much fun and it's not very hard work. And unless you happen to like the president who's going to appoint your successor, why bother?
Mm-hmm. So one of the major calls here is for justices to move to senior status after 18 years on the court.
Yeah. You mentioned the text of the Constitution. That there is an argument about what is the constitutional limitation on term limits or age limits or something of that sort. The text of the Constitution really doesn't restrict us very much. Constitutional scholars who take a broad view of the language would like to make it say life tenure, but all it says is they can serve for good behavior. And what that means, that language was not thought about at the time. That language was put in the federal Constitution, drawn from the British Act, Parliament's Act of Settlement of 1701, in which they said the king's judges serve for good behavior. And that's all it says. And the Parliament has long since gotten around to saying, well, there's an age limit. You can't stay past 75. And no one has written a constitution yet that actually puts in life tenure. For that's for royalty, okay?
Huh.
And it's not So I don't know. I don't think the Constitution really speaks very strongly to the issue. It does mean you couldn't put, I think it does limit you in the ability to say, well, we're going to have short-term limits or retention elections of the sort we have in many states or any of that sort of thing. But I do think some long-term limit would be perfectly consistent with the idea of serving for good behavior.
Right. So if we looked at 18 years now, it was amazing to me how much of the court would change if Congress somehow decided to accept all of your proposals.
Yeah,
here.
Well,
they'd be almost all gone, right?
Well, no, because we put it in. We made it all futuristic. It's the proposal as we wrote it is only that kicks in as the present membership of the court rotates off.
I see.
So we're not. We were trying to make it very clear. We're not after any present justice.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe if that law statute was enacted, some of them might begin to feel some stronger obligation to subside when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we thought something like actually the system we were proposing is simply that the president appoint and the Senate confirm one justice every term of court, every term of Congress. So every 2 years you get a new Supreme Court justice. And then the nine junior most would sit on the cases, which approximates an 18-year term. But it wouldn't be perfect because some people would die within the 18 years or retire or become disabled and quit. Other situations might complicate it a little, so it's not standard. And we would keep the older justices around to fill in when somebody's disqualified and can't sit on a particular case, and we'd keep them in the rulemaking process and the other kinds of things that the Supreme Court does. It closely resembles what in fact happens with United States circuit judges.
Oh.
Because they have, as do the Supreme Court justices, a wonderful retirement scheme. You can quit at full pay, okay?
Hmm. That's a good deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And most circuit judges do quit at somewhere around 18 years and take their full pay. And they do keep senior status, most of them, and can continue to come back and sit on cases when they're needed. And that's a very common situation for lower federal court judges. And so there is that. What we were proposing kind of resembles that.
Professor Carrington, is it fairly commonplace for justices who may be in failing health or who may be extremely elderly to stay on the bench because of the status of this? You said they didn't have to work very hard. Why is it they have to be smart, of course, but why is it that people would not realize that perhaps it's time to let somebody younger enter this incredibly important body?
I don't have a good answer to that. I mean, there are numerous examples of judges who have Sandra Day O'Connor did quit not long ago. And I admired her for doing it. She was an unusual person in modern times to have done that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who should have been told, sir, it's time for you to subside, is William Rehnquist.
Mm-hmm.
The last year that he was Chief Justice, he was in the hospital.
Yeah.
And there ought to be a way to say to Bill Rehnquist, Bill, we need to get another Chief Justice in here. It is mm-hmm. time for you to take a little. And, you still have full pay and you can do other interesting things and go around and talk to people and write.
Sure.
One of the things Supreme Court justices are into these days are writing books. They got enough time that while they're sitting on the court, they can dash off a history book or an autobiography or something. And I know Nino Scalia was out in Florida a week or so ago peddling his book. I don't object to their writing books, but they ought to be. There are a lot of cases that could benefit
yes.
from their attention,
excellent.
And they just don't.
Excellent idea. Yeah.
They just don't bother.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about that because that's really pretty dramatic. I didn't know that they receive thousands of petitions every
yeah.
year, and they just don't take many cases, and they do decide, as you say, what cases it is they will take. So tell me
yeah.
about the process and why there are so few cases they take.
Well, the process that they now have in place, and they've been empowered by Congress. This really started mostly in 22 and 25 acts I was conflating. But anyway, in the 1920s, Congress really went for this in a fairly big way, and now in 1988, they made it virtually complete that the Supreme Court doesn't have to take any cases unless they decide they want to take them. And they just leave them with the lower federal courts. There are a lot of cases that would benefit from a higher authority that are not considered. And that was really the subject of some of those previous reports I had mentioned, like the one I worked on 40 years ago. Part of what we were saying is that the lower federal courts are not organized to deal to create a definitive and clear solution to a lot of questions of statutory interpretation. And somebody ought to be able to say, this is what we meant with this statute, and Congress, inevitably leaves some ambiguities. And the Supreme Court ought to take those cases. Well, they don't. Maybe every now and then they'll feel like, well, if there are four or five lower courts that have been confused about this, maybe now we'll take it. But there's no, in my view, no real excuse for that. When they first got this power, the judges promised that they would continue to decide the same number of cases, which was 300 a year.
300?
Yes.
Oh,
they were deciding 300 cases a year. Very gradually, the number has gone down to about 70.
Oh, my gosh. What do they do? Take longer lunch hours? Or what's the story?
Well, yes. They take the summer off.
Oh, all right.
And they, they do have about 70 oral arguments a year that they have to attend. But now, how do they pick the cases? Part of the little bit of a problem some of us have with it is a lot of that responsibility is sort of delegated. I don't want to overstate their abandonment of responsibility. I do think they take some, but a few years ago, they created something called the cert pool, which is a pool of junior law clerks who are responsible for reviewing all of the certiorari petitions and recommending cases to be considered by the court. So a lot of that study of the cases is being done by recent graduates of law schools. They're all very smart, very able guys, carefully selected. They've been had a year on the Court of Appeals also with some circuit judge. And then they get promoted to be a Supreme Court law clerk. And then some of them are delegated to take the job of managing this so-called certiorari pool, of in which the clerks get together and try to make a recommendation to the justices about what they should do. And they are complicated questions, but it is you do have to be a little bit spooked by the fact that the justices aren't paying full heed to what petitioners are saying to them when they beg for the court's attention. They're just they don't have time for that.
Right.
And so that was one of the things we were trying to address or get Congress to think about. And our proposal is simply that the cert pool of law clerks be sort of replaced by a panel of circuit judges who are veteran circuit judges and who might tell the Supreme Court that here are, we suggested maybe 80 cases a year that you have to decide. You can pick some more. We're not going to foreclose them from picking any cases they think are important enough to consider. But we'd like to put some cases on their agenda that they would have a duty to decide.
Let's welcome phone calls for Professor Paul Carrington, professor of law at Duke University. And we're talking about four proposals for a Judiciary Act of 2009. Changes to the Supreme Court that really have not been looked at significantly. He talked about the many commissions, some of them he's been on 40 years ago and since then, but some changes that might be beneficial for the running of our American democracy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We do want to tell you, if you want to read the letter while you're listening to our program, it's on our website, too. If you go to WPR.org and to program notes for our show, Kathleen Dunn, you'll be able to see the proposals of provisions suitable for inclusion in the Judiciary Act for 2009, four proposals for the act, and it's well worth your reading and listening to our talking about it as well. Our number here, 800-486-8655. And our guest is Professor Paul Carrington, professor of law at Duke University. We go to Scott from La Crosse first. Hi, Scott.
Good morning to you both. Thank you for another wonderful show, Kathleen. I've got an idea which I'm going to describe as a flash of brilliance.
Okay.
How about that?
We sure need some of those.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm the source for those things, Professor. How about this? If one of the things that is a real issue in our state, and I know others, is this business of we are not really comfortable with how we elect our state Supreme Court justices.
Right.
How
so.
We get them there. And what would happen if you could establish this group, like these Justice Emeriti, or Emeritus, or whatever, I forgot to study Latin. What happens if you would establish this group, and governors would come up with their candidates for Supreme Court, and then these would be the folks who would decide on them? And really what I'm thinking is you could do this in this issue, because I think it's one that needs addressing and they would obviously have a certain degree of expertise to bring to bear. But couldn't you expand that and have this like be a group of almost like wise elders for all kinds of thorny legal issues where they might not they wouldn't have power to render a decision, but they would have opinions that would be very, very, very influential. And I would think that if you were a Supreme Court justice and you could look upon your golden years being spent in that kind of a venue where, you know, it wouldn't be a lot of work, but it would be the kind of thing where you would stay active and, you know, you'd be outweighed if you were a little too far around the bend, that would have a certain appeal that would make it go down easier to say, you know, you're going to go to the Supreme Court. And then you had to go to the Wise Elder Hall of Fame. I mean,
right? That people have done that in the past. Byron White did for a little while. I mean, he was author of the fifth of the reports and primary author, chair of the group, and he did do that. And Sandra Day O'Connor is presently, actively engaged. I've been at a couple of conferences that she was at and speaking to. And people do listen to what she has to say and are interested in her and her ideas. So I don't think people who leave the Supreme Court of the United States are really in a state of neglect. That they have plenty left to do. I'm not sure you were speaking of the state courts, and I suppose they don't have much to do with the administration of state judges or the state justice or the selection of state judges. It would be a perfectly reasonable job for them to do if they were asked to do it. I'm sure they would if you needed a little help guiding the governor of Wisconsin and selecting judges. I'm sure there's some federal judges who'd be happy to give you their opinions. They certainly are not people who are neglected over the years. But there have not been a lot of them who've done that, let me say. Most of the judges, justices, have stayed on longer than they should have. One who was particularly troubling for me, because I admired him greatly as a person, but I knew the last 2 years he was on the court were really a mistake, and that was Thurgood Marshall.
Why were they a mistake?
Huh?
Why were they a mistake?
Well, he just was disabled. He wasn't. Mm. He was. He was. superannuated, and his health didn't permit him to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what he was doing was sitting there and voting with Bill Brennan. Whatever Brennan says is I go with, because mm-hmm. I like him better than I like you other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a fine judge and a fine justice and a fine lawyer, and he had a great career, and it's just too bad he had to spend the last year or two of it. And the reason he did it was partly he did not want President Bush to appoint his successor. So he held on until he died.
Mm-hmm.
And then President Bush did appoint Clarence Thomas.
Right.
But Thomas is another example to think of if you're thinking about life tenure. He was appointed at a very early age, 40-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unreasonable to think that Clarence Thomas could be there for 50 years.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that a thought? 50 years on the court.
Yeah, well, 50 years on the court. Could be. And part of the problem is that we are, and I'm an example of this, holding on at a ripe age and continuing to maintain some measure of health and conscience, consciousness. And
mm-hmm.
and so it's easily imaginable that we're going to have people hanging on to the court for 50 years. So that was one of the stimuli for the effort a couple of years ago to try to think about term limits or age limits or something.
Right. It does make you think. 50 years. Do you have anything else, Scott?
No, I'm happy. I really think that I love your ideas. I mean, I think it's well overdue. I've heard these stories as well about the way the court had worked around. I think Douglas was another one that.
And, yes.
And even maybe so. Holmes.
Yeah.
I heard maybe
yes,
towards the end.
Also,
just so past it that it was really they had to just kind of. And I've also heard though that in a lot of those cases it's really the clerks that are representing the justice. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to overstate that, but certainly the office of Supreme Court law clerk is an important office.
Mm-hmm.
It is not an office without consequence.
Mm-hmm.
They are not just servants. They do have some impact on, and it varies obviously according to who the judge is. Some judges are much more deferential to their clerks. From what I've read, I think as he aged, Justice Blackmun got particularly keen on listening to what his clerks had to say and letting them do the work. And others had no patience. One of the problems with Douglas is he couldn't use a clerk. He kept firing his law clerks. One of the things you had to learn when you went to work for Bill Douglas is you're going to get fired every now and then, and when you do, just come back to work tomorrow. And because he doesn't really mean it. He's just so irritable.
Oh,
that,
my gosh.
He does. He limited himself to one clerk. But Douglas is an example. Douglas had an iron rule about picking cases. He didn't want to hear any tax cases.
Oh my!
And his explanation was, if it's so complicated that it gets all the way up here, then the government hadn't done a good job of writing the tax laws, and we shouldn't have to think about it. And the taxpayer wins.
Thanks so much, Scott, for your call. Here's an email that's come in that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to see 10 justices on the Supreme Court. An even number would require a larger consensus and prevent a slim majority from deciding a case without the minority.
Well, it's an idea. I don't. It's a little contrary to the tradition of all of our courts. I don't think we have any courts that have even numbers, but it's plausible, and it would. It's not going to happen because the justices would be frantic to oppose it. But it would require them to. Organize themselves in a little different way, and it might be very constructive. I don't know. I don't know how it would really work.
Huh. Let's go to Laura from Madison next. Hi, Laura.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Very interesting topic. Thank you. I've been very interested in this. I wonder, has anyone suggested that the judges, if we're going to start changing things, be appointed by a bipartisan commission, perhaps a congressional commission, perhaps not, a little bit different than older judges appointing them?
Well, of course, the Constitution does provide they're going to be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Now, you could get the president imaginably, the president and the Senate could get together and try to work out some system that was politically disinterested in the way you suggest. But I don't. I think it's got to be the president who undertakes to do this. Now, let me say, President Carter was quite interested in this, and he did create bipartisan groups in each federal district. 84. There were 84 committees, and then one for each court of appeals that did have responsibility. And he appointed a lot of Republican Republicans to the federal bench, and they were selected. The guy who was primarily in charge of it was a law school classmate of mine named Mike Egan, who's one of the 30 odd people in the group.
Oh.
And Mike was a Republican in the Carter administration who picked judges. But he did it through this committee structure. Now, nobody's ever applied that to the Supreme Court. It really, you know, the Supreme Court appointments weren't a big deal until really...
Until Roe v. Wade?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really Roe against Wade that excited the passions of a lot of people, and the first really bitter... There was a bitter struggle over Louis Brandeis's appointment. Six presidents of the American Bar Association opposed his confirmation. But it was basically anti-Semitism that was involved. Well, he was also, he'd had some, done some liberal things as a lawyer politically that antagonized Taft. He was one of the cases, one of the very few cases in which there really was a controversy about the appointment.
It just seems that some of the ugly wrangling over, you know, about appointees sometimes comes pretty purely because people in Congress don't like the president in power, and those, you know,
sure.
And if it were clear that they came from a bipartisan commission, maybe less of our time would be spent wrangling over all of this.
Yeah, well, there was very little wrangling during the Carter years with the lower federal courts. And now we have gotten in a position where even the lower federal courts it takes them forever to make an appointment. For a while, it worked pretty well. One of the things that was going on that started long before the Carter years, it must have been somewhere about 1960, somewhere along in there, the American Bar Association appointed a group, elegant, pretentious group, who evaluated nominees to the federal bench, and they would rate them as qualified or highly qualified or super high or unqualified. The only one I remember that they rated unqualified was somebody that John Kennedy nominated, who was his mother's chauffeur.
Oh my!
Who'd gone to law school?
Oh my! Really? I've never heard that story.
And he'd gone to law school in the evening, and gotten to be a lawyer, and so Kennedy's mom said to her son, "Why don't you make him a federal judge?" And the ABA blocked that one. And they blocked a few others of people who were highly political appointees. But and the senators actually, I think, kind of liked that. The senators don't necessarily benefit from having the responsibility they have had for local appointees. People think their U.S. senator can fix them up. And so I remember hearing from one senator many years ago telling me every time there was a vacancy this was Senator Yarbrough in Texas, that every time we got a federal judicial vacancy, I get five letters from constituents who want me to appoint them, and one of them gets appointed and the other four hate me. So I'd like to be out of this business.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's certainly a part of it. Now, senators have not had less influence by Supreme Court justices, but they used to have a lot, and it used to be a lot more amiable process. One of the best federal judges we've had in my lifetime was a guy named Richard Arnold, who was chief judge of the Eighth Circuit for a spell. He was a native of Texarkana, Arkansas, sat on the Eighth Circuit for a number of years, and was a wonderful, wonderful judge. And he told me the story about his appointment, which was kind of fun. He was working in the office of Senator Bumpers. And one day Bumpers stuck his nose in the door and said, "Dick, how'd you like to go on the United States Court of Appeals?" And And Arnold said, well, I'd kind of like that. And so he said, okay, I'm going to nominate you to the president. And then they went out to going out to lunch, and they got on the elevator on the fourth floor of the Senate office building, and Bumpers and the other guy who got on the elevator was, I think it was Senator Dirksen, I don't know, some Republican senator who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And Bumpers introduced him, Arnold, to this guy and said, this is the guy I'm going to nominate to be on the Eighth Circuit. And when they got off the elevator, the Senate chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee said, well, congratulations, Your Honor. I'm pleased to have met you, Judge.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was all over. So, you know, it happened that Arnold was very well qualified in terms of his academic status and the experience he'd had. It was a very good appointment, and nobody ever questioned it. But now it takes months. They've got to do all sorts of investigations to see what, it's part of it is partisan politics.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Laura, so much for your call. Thanks.
Thank you.
We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Mark from Janesville. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. I might have a bad connection, so I'll be brief. I'm
okay.
An attorney. I've done a lot of appellate work, and at the federal circuit level of appeals, they have a panel that's larger than the number that actually hears the case, and they swap the people in and out, so you don't really know until the morning you show up to argue who's going to be on your case.
Yeah.
If we added a panel system at the Supreme Court where you had maybe 18 justices or something more, they could get back to hearing a couple hundred cases a year reasonably, have a good lifestyle, and have the time to do it right. Because at this point, at 70 or so a year, there's just a whole lot of difference in the jurisdictions, and we really need more cases from this. This is the branch of government that may have some of the most control. It is the most opaque, and it can direct the president or change the law, and that has to happen. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a lot more cases going through the Supreme Court during the Bush administration when they were waterboarding and torturing.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. You know, thank you.
Well, it's good.
Thanks,
Mark. Actually, what he's suggesting resembles the what's basically the Supreme Court of Germany. They have two panels. I don't know whether it's seven or nine, whether it's, you know, 14 or 18 judges. But they manage somehow to be consistent with one another. They do shift around, and but they respect one another's judgments, and so they understand the principle of precedent. They also have some other features that distinguish them. They have a much longer, the basic law in Germany is much longer, so they're not wandering around with so little textual guidance from the Constitution. One of the things that makes our constitutional law such a problem is the Constitution doesn't answer any of the questions, hardly. Ergo, the one we were talking about here, about how long can
right.
justices stay on the court? Well, they can stay for good behavior. What does that mean? And we've never tested that. But there are a lot of other phrases in the Constitution of the Supreme Court, Constitution of the United States, that leave you with a good deal of room for speculating about what that means.
Right. And, yeah, it is. It's a vague statement, isn't it? For
yeah,
good
well,
behavior.
It's a very brief
good
document.
Behavior.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, compare the German Constitution's a couple hundred pages, and ours is five? I don't know how you count plus the amendments. Maybe it's seven or eight, but it's a very short document. So the Supreme Court's making up a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Professor Paul Carrington is our guest, professor of law at Duke University. There have been a lot of articles in the last week highlighting his and other legal experts' proposal to really change the structure of the Supreme Court to limit the justices' powers and their terms. Our guest says, and the letter has been recently delivered to the vice president, to the attorney general, the chair and ranking minority party members of the Congressional Judiciary Committees, calling for reforms. Our guest says, we do not suggest and would oppose any interference with the substance of the court's work, but they would like to see Congress addressing how the court operates, which they have every right to do, a subject it appears not to have taken seriously for at least 70 years. Interesting ideas here and proposed changes. A couple lines open, 800-486-8655. Email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Paul Carrington, professor of law at Duke University, our guest. And he's written a lot of books and has a creative mind, as you can see, and is concerned about how the Supreme Court functions. We're talking about the document that was sent to the vice president, attorney general, and other important people to make some proposed changes. There are four proposals in this letter about ways that they think the Supreme Court could function more efficiently and be more in touch with the concerns of Americans. Doug from Wisconsin Rapids is our next caller. Hello, Doug.
Good morning. Sorry for the reception, but I'm getting popping right around Portage here.
Okay.
But just a quick comment. How is the Senate going to come up with a selection committee or even a bipartisan committee when you got Mr. Byrd from West Virginia who's 92 years old? I think he's going to say, oh, leave him on for after they die. You know, that
yeah.
type of thing.
Yeah.
A couple
yeah.
of comments was that when Justice Bader was in the hospital with cancer and had her surgery, and my spouse said, really, she's that old, you know? And I said, they're on there for life, you know? So it'd be kind of hard to get something going like that, but I admire your and stick to it, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And then also limit them. These guys only want to limit themselves to their own terms of, say, three terms in the Senate and three terms in the House or such a matter. Can be reelected, you know, but got to wait, sit out for a term. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks for the call. Professor Carrington, you want to respond?
Well, I share his view that it's going to be hard to do, and there are some senators who are superannuated. We had one who was 100 years old sometime in the last decade. Who am I thinking about? Anyway.
Who was that?
They do. He was the Southern candidate for president. And
we'll find out. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, somebody will tell us.
Yes.
Anyway, the superannuation of the Senate, you can at least say, well, the voters are sending them back in. And so there is at least some accountability. Somebody is deciding that it's okay for them to stay in office for another 6 years. And you can't say that about Supreme Court justices. They are really not accountable to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that's a basic problem. One item that's on the agenda there that nobody's asked about has to do with the Chief Justice.
Oh, yes, right.
And one of the things that's happened in the 75 years that we've not been thinking about it, since we created the Judicial Conference, the Chief Justice is the chairman of the Judicial Conference. And that turns out to be quite a powerful office. He appoints all the committees of the judiciary that go about resolving things like rules of civil procedure, rules of criminal procedure, rules of appellate procedure. There are a bunch of other committees that he appoints that have very important responsibilities. How did that happen? Well, it just happened by chance. Nobody ever said that's the way to do things, and so we've accumulated a lot of additional duties for the Chief Justice beyond sitting on cases, and that suggests that maybe there ought to be some kind of term limit for that administrative responsibility. Maybe somebody shouldn't be sitting there as Rehnquist did for 25 years as Chief Justice and exercising sort of complete autocratic responsibility over the governance of the federal judiciary and appointing all its committees and doing everything and controlling everything. Everybody who wanted a committee assignment had to win it from Bill Rehnquist. And maybe there ought to be some kind of additional shorter term limit for that office,
right,
so that every now and then the President of the United States and Congress could decide whether we don't need a new Chief Justice. So there's some accountability for all of that political responsibility that office is exercising. That's the word I would like to share with the justices and with the, and I, and it's sort of implicit in our letter, and that is a little accountability is a good thing. We want judicial independence. It's very important that the judges be independent. But they also need to have, they are human beings, and they are subject to the same kind of frailties the rest of us are. And they do need a little a moment of accountability every now and then.
Right.
And we've sort of cut all of that out.
Yeah.
And there never was very much, let me say. But one of the things they used to do for 100 years, it was the tradition of the Supreme Court, that if they had a superannuated justice that wasn't doing the job anymore, they would have a meeting and designate the junior justice and tell him to go tell the superannuated justice that he should quit.
I like your choice of terms here.
And they did that for a long time. And I think it was Holmes who was told as a junior member of the court to go tell Justice Field that he should quit.
Oh,
and,
my.
And Justice Field told him to go to blazes. he went ahead. And so that was kind of the end of that system.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work anymore. But something like that does need to be done. And I say they need to be forced to decide some cases, in my view. That is another form of accountability, to hold them to a workload that is appropriate.
Yeah. Our producer, Rob Schroeder, has come up, been playing on the internet, and
yeah.
It was Strom Thurmond who had the 100th
yes,
birthday party.
Yes, Thurmond is right. Yeah. That's who we were talking about.
Just so we didn't let everybody worry about that
for the
rest of the morning. Paul from Madison is our next caller.
Okay.
Hi, Paul.
Well, I would have told you that about Strom Thurmond if your producer hadn't called it up off the internet first. My point for this, you're talking about these people being on the Supreme Court, but how about a few words, some thought given to how they get to be considered for nomination in the first place? John Grisham has a recent novel called The Appeal, which illustrates the case in his version of Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Which is appears to be quite a broad method of picking these people in recent decades, where they're picked off appeals courts and they validate their qualifications for the job by basically reversing primary court verdicts, giving lots of money to people in injury cases and so forth. And then you have the situation of John Yoo, who in the past decade wrote these opinions, you know, favoring what W. N. Cheney wanted to do inside the Beltway. He was involved in some office this or committee that, and he apparently saw it as a springboard to the Supreme Court by way of becoming head of this office or this committee, and this is something that I, for one, at least, had never heard of before, and I'm from that part of the country.
Well, I think picking Supreme Court justices is an interesting question, and Chief Justice Roberts just had something to say about it last week, with which I profoundly disagree. Roberts was saying it's really a wonderful thing that all nine justices are veterans of service on the United States Courts of Appeals. And he says that reduces the political furor. Well, I don't think so. And I think part of the problem that the court has developed over the last 40 or 50 years, it's in its public relationships, and they are worried about this. The justices themselves will say people don't respect us enough, they don't love us enough, they don't believe in judicial independence. They want to change the court, and of course, part of that has to do, as we mentioned earlier, with Roe against Wade and the reaction of people who are really troubled by that more than anything else. But the part of the problem, I think, is that we don't have any justices who've ever had any political experience. We don't have a single justice who ever ran for public office, who ever sat on a legislature, who ever drafted a law, who ever tried to negotiate the resolution of a dispute in a legislature. They are all good lawyers, let me say, but they do not have a respect for the political process because they're not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been part of their problem. We've developed a system now which Sandy Levinson of Texas, who's one of the members of the group, characterizes as kind of bearing a certain resemblance to the Roman Catholic vision of cardinals who serve forever and who tell us what to think and what to believe and how what our faith is. And it is a a different kind of role than was practiced by a bunch of other justices over the course of the history of the Supreme Court, who really had a lot of experience both in politics and in law practice. And I think it would be a better court if we had at least one former senator and one former state Supreme Court judge and one former congressman and one former well, whatever else you'd like to think of at the moment. There are a number of different kinds of careers that would be appropriate. And
That's a real interesting idea. Should have put that in the letter.
Yeah, we don't have any of that in the court anymore.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Carrington. It was just a real delight to speak with you, and good luck with everything.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Professor Paul Carrington, he's a professor of law at Duke University, and you can find the letter that we've been referencing. It's on our website, too, for those of you who are keenly interested in this. It's the four proposals for a Judiciary Act of 2009, and if you go to WPR.org and maneuver around to the Kathleen Dunn Show, you'll be able to read this whole letter. It's very, very interesting. Well, thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the hour, and to Rob as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. As always, thanks for your calls, everybody. Don't you love it when the Ideas Network really is the Ideas Network? It's just a whole new idea. It's good. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.